Hello. Here we are at the turn of seasons as it finally comes to be autumn in the city that many of you can no longer be in. And here we are in the midst of the loudest and most distressing presidential political campaign of my lifetime. After all, now been through, as a biological matter, 15 of them, and as a sentient, politically aware human being, 13 of them, and this is surely far and away the most difficult to stomach. But at any rate, we have reached also the point in our conversation in which we can begin to see fully what the decay of intellectual property rules meant in the history of the rise of the net, and what the practical, legal, and political consequences are of those fundamental changes in the political economy of software. We have, as I have made myself no doubt tedious by saying, we have built an extraskeletal nervous system embracing the human species that we call the Internet, which we are constructing so rapidly that we will, by the end of this decade, have basically brought every human being into the reach of the net all the time. And every human mind from birth to death will, by the end of this generation, develop entirely in relation to that external nervous system. It consists, from an anatomical point of view, of pipes and switches, that is, message carriers and deciders about what messages are to be carried and what messages are to be carried back from wherever the ostensible, more important first message is delivered, as a result of which all media of communication and entertainment, to the extent that they are now different, all the things that carry the vituperation and the lies and the envy-producing bragging about the beauty of one's vacation and the excellence of one's children and all the other things that we have come to consider necessities of daily life, all of them are built on top of spying, and they are therefore built on top of the sustenance demanded by the parasite with the mind of God, that is, the collection of all human behavior and the attribution of every human action paid for in return by little snippets of convenience and sexual arousal and appetite for pretty things and all the other forms of emotional interaction, genuine on the human side and completely artificial on the side of the parasite with the mind of God, that is our new way of human being. But all of that depends upon how the switches work, that they distribute what is intended to be given at the price and on the conditions which it is to be paid for, and to collect all the resulting behavior to be analyzed by those who wish to advertise and by those who wish to oppress. How the switches work is determined by the software inside them, which provides the physiology of this nervous system and which therefore determines whether it is a nervous system built to make people more free or less free. Software is politics because who controls the switches is the subject of 21st century politics, and the switches are controlled by software, and those who control the software therefore control human lives. I'm not particularly proud that I so happen to be a kid who knew this early, that just had to do with the way in which my life in the post-war United States, in New York City and in Westchester County, interacted with or intersected with or was acted upon by the beginnings of the digital revolution. But that 15-year-old me who said to my father, in the 21st century, there will be two kinds of human beings, those who know how to control the behavior of computers and those who don't, and those who don't will be the slaves of those who do, that 15-year-old turned out, as adolescents sometimes will, to have got it basically right with a little bit of emotional overreaction built in. But if it isn't slavery to be a Uyghur in the People's Republic of China, it's not for want of the Chinese Communist Party's trying. If it feels a little bit like living in a police state to be a Hong Konger now, it's because of software. Of course, at the other end of the software is a phone in the hands of a policeman receiving orders to beat people or not to notice that other people are beating people in a subway station. But that's precisely the way in which the human being loses rights to the machine and gains convenience in return. All of this might seem a long way from the question of how to make money selling computers, but it isn't really. It's two steps. The first was the recognition that came to others at the end of the 20th century, and to which I and my little cohort of fools had been adherent for 15 years before that, the recognition that sharing beats owning in the making of software. Once the network allows a very large number of people to collaborate in the building of computer programs in simple ways. In the conversations we've had over the past couple of weeks, on the pad, in the park, on the phone, via the wiki, people's recurrent desire to understand what is the incentive to make software has remained vital no matter how many times I ask them, what is people's incentive to play in the park or to make music? Because we came in the course of the 20th century to believe so strongly in the myth of human incentive, which is essentially an industrial myth centered around the retroactive recognition that those who do not work should not eat, that we have forgotten how much of human social activity is incentivized by the emotional condition of human beings, whether that incentive is reverence or desire for sexual or other forms of affection, or the extraordinary pleasure that we get from helping other people, or from the inherent need that to create that force that through the green fuse drives the flower, in Dylan Thomas's phrase, which every one of us has experienced in relation to some form of creative activity, dancing, making music, or painting, or drawing, or sculpting, or making computer programs. This may seem to be an unusual addition, this making of computer program stuff. And yet, to me, when I met the computer when I was 12 years old and started to figure out how to make it do things I wanted it to do by writing things down in BASIC, it has never for an instant since I was losing my milk teeth been the case that I didn't take immediate creative pleasure from making computers do things. And all the technology we use in this course, in all my courses, in my practice, all of the technology that I use to make my living, if that's what it is I'm doing, and that we use together to make your learning, which I believe is certainly what we are doing, all of that technology is run by me because I want to. The computers that house our wiki and pad and everything else that we employ, if they are physical computers, the pad is located under Newark Airport on a shared computer, as it happens, but let's not worry about that. The communications that I have with you occur on hardware that I built myself from loose parts, onto which I loaded every bit of software which is in it, all of it free software, that is to say, software not only that I didn't have to pay for that was gratis, but software that was libre, software that allowed me to make changes in it in any way I wanted and to share those changes with anybody I pleased, and which gave me all the material I needed in order to make whatever modifications I required, and which is maintained by me and supported by me and operated by me for all of us, which in this epidemic environment is a fewer us than usual by a little bit, but which is often hundreds of students a term, because I like doing it that way. That's the way I like to work. I derive satisfaction from making sure that everything is nicely organized and all put together soundly and securely, and that everybody gets the services that she and he needs in my classes without giving up any information to any Google anywhere unnecessarily. And all of that is really the same form of satisfaction in the creation of technical sufficiency which led me to want to write little programs in BASIC for the call of computer GE365 in 1971, or that made me want to write mainframe software on an IBM 4341 Mod 11 little water-cooled mainframe sitting in a laboratory in California that I and my colleagues use to make APL interpreters with, or any of the other kinds of technical work that I have done over the decades. And so to me, it's not surprising to discover that there are 12-year-olds who can and will and want to and indeed would have to be stopped from making software. What happened in the late 20th century as the beginnings of our new nervous system came into existence was that all the fun that was had by all the people making technology could be coordinated, not directed, not authorized, not forced into being by the labor discipline of the army of industrial knowledge workers, but rather by the simple process of making it possible for them to share. By using the network's flexibility in storage and patterns of communication to allow people spread around the world, maybe 1,000 of them, to work simultaneously on making one computer program better. By 1999, in Anarchism Triumphant, I was able to declare that the process of building software by sharing had achieved the goal of software engineering that was the grail of my teenage and years, my 20s, into my 30s, that we would eventually be able to engineer software in such a way that we could write once, run anywhere. This was the technical problem originally presented to the Bell System, the American monopoly. AT&T was the single largest producer of computers in the world in the 1960s. Bigger than IBM, but AT&T consumed all its computers internally. It digitized the telephone system in which it had a monopoly in the United States in order to make that monopoly deeper and more profitable, and in doing so, it built a just an immensity of computing, but the computing that it built had to be different as it learned its way into the making and manufacturing of computers at a time when there were fewer standardized understandings about how to make hardware and software, and it needed all of those computers to work together to build one telephone network. This was what motivated the computer scientists at Bell Labs, beginning in 1966 and really gathering speed in 1969, around the creation of an operating system that would unify all those computers, whatever was their hardware architecture and physical means of construction, inside one software environment called Unix, one ring to rule them all, whose job it was to bring uniformity out of complexity by allowing every computer, no matter what its physical design was like, to share as much of the same operating system as possible, which was essentially the beginning of the task pursued in the mid-1970s through the Defense Department's Advanced Research Products Agency to build a network of computers which didn't have to care how those particular computers were designed in hardware or implemented in software, so long as they could obey a set of concentric protocols, rules of communication, which could be implemented inside those computers in different ways, so long as at the end they understood the rules of how to pass messages around. These works of generalization motivated the pioneers in the world of free software, most importantly my old friend and comrade and client Richard Stallman, to imagine a Unix-like operating environment for computers, every part of which had been written by people who agreed to share the code. The consequence of which would be to allow any computer anywhere to do all the things that the free software operating system and its applications allowed computers to do, because all the code would be available to everybody and everybody could change it, improve it, share it, and pass it along. Software environments then came to be designed for what the network would allow people to do best, which was to share and improve and make everything better for each person, each user, each bunch of users located anywhere where the computers were. Because in the world of which we are now speaking, the personal computer revolution had yet to take full hold, and people shared computers, which was part of why it was obviously possible that they could also share the code. Sharing, however, was not the only point that was before the eyes of the people who made this write once, run everywhere software environment possible. The other motivating concern was that users should have rights. This is where the intellectual property system and the realities of software came first into conflict. Computer software didn't seem, to the copyright thinkers of the 1960s, to be copyrightable at all. It wasn't, in their judgment, works of creative authorship. This was an error, as it turned out. We could have told them. But the copyright thinkers weren't kids like us, and they really didn't know. And software didn't seem to be a particularly good subject for patenting either, although companies like IBM and the AT&T Bell system certainly would have used patenting for software and began in a few cases to try. In 1979, the Cantu Commission in the United States, a blue ribbon policymaking commission of experts, came to the conclusion that copyright rather than patent was the appropriate means of protecting software. But mostly, software came to be protected, as Microsoft's then chief technology officer Craig Mundie said in the 1990s. The secret of the software industry is never give anybody the source code to anything. In other words, trade secrecy became the primary means by which vertically integrated software manufacturers made their software. But that idea of secrecy, that you should never show anybody the source code to anything, hinged on the fact that Microsoft, powerful as it was, had only a kind of product to make, namely software. Microsoft occasionally made hardware, lumpy keyboards and strange mice and stuff like that, but they were never a hardware company, and even now, as you see, that's not really their forte. Microsoft, therefore, was the first pure software company to become extraordinarily powerful in the industry, and it saw software as trade secret product to be sold under shrink wrap. That wasn't the attitude taken about software in the prior era, when IBM was the model of the dominant company. The IBM for which I went to work in 1979, just as the Cantu Commission was trying to figure out how intellectual property applied to software, the IBM I went to work with sold extraordinarily powerful and expensive computers. Their power is dwarfed by what you can now put on the palm of your hand, because the hardware engineers have been building rocket ships that run on pure hydrogen for two generations now and have exceeded all human expectations for what they could achieve. Software, I regret to say, has not improved anywhere near as much as hardware has. But expensive they still were. The IBM mainframes of that time were multi-million dollar purchases, and multi-million dollar purchases they remained. IBM, in other words, wanted software to improve the experience for the companies that bought the highly expensive hardware that it sold. And those of us who made hardware for IBM, software for IBM's mainframes, we're therefore making things to be shared with the users of IBM's computing products in a business rational sense. We published all the source code of all the programs that I worked on, and we encouraged the knowledgeable people who provided technical and software support to the owners of IBM mainframes to read that source code and to find and report bugs with proposed improvements to fix the problems. The goal of the companies that sold expensive hardware was to empower their users, but their users were the collective force of the automobile company or the oil company or the tobacco company or whatever it was to which they were selling computers. So in the world from which I had grown up, and all of those of us who didn't need no stinking badges to be young computer types in the 1970s or earlier, the world in which we grew up and made software was a world in which the dominant companies were hardware manufacturing companies who saw software as value added and enablement for their customers and who therefore wanted to share, but they didn't have a good network for sharing over. Software was distributed on reels of magnetic tape. And the user groups of the IBM Corporation spread over 1,000 different areas of interest mailed magnetic tapes around so that people could have versions of software on which the user groups had collaborated in improving performance and fixing problems. But the important point was that the users' rights were established in arm's length dealing between powerful businesses seeking to cooperate for the benefit of the manufacturer in relation to its customers. The rise of the personal computer, which IBM made open hardware in the sense that, unlike the products of the King of the Undead, now dead at Apple, the IBM PC had an architecture which was fully published and everybody could see everything and everybody could make everything, at least to the extent that they had acquired necessary patent licenses. The consequence of which was that the PC proliferated and the software that operated it became the bottleneck, and Microsoft became the dominant company. IBM nearly lost its way in that period. It could have bought DOS from Microsoft and owned it completely, but it thought for antitrust reasons that it would be better off for the IBM Corporation to license software from some third party, which made the PC's operating system. And in making that decision, a decision made at a time when I was a young, technically proficient former IBM employee in law school working as a summer lawyer for the IBM legal department, I watched that set of decisions made, beginning as a technician and ending as a fledgling lawyer. In that process, IBM nearly gave away its business and had the first of its subsequent near-death experiences. But the ownership of software in a collection of overlapping legal domains, you might want to ask yourself just for a moment, how could software be simultaneously copyrighted and trade secret? Wouldn't it be necessary, in order to have the copyright, to have deposited a copy of the software source code such that it couldn't be a secret also? That's the whole point of the copyright bargain, isn't it? Rights of exclusion in return for publication? I'll leave as an exercise for the reader the effort to square trade secrecy and copyright in software, well, for a week, or maybe only until the pad on Wednesday. But you should think about it, because it is the inherent legal contradiction to which that era gave birth. So the very concentration on the idea of software as the rights of its producer, trade secret rights, copyrights, potentially patent rights, was entirely in keeping with the general proprietization of knowledge after the Second World War, the rise of the enormous pharma companies, and their control over the patent system was just another example. But at the same time that that proprietization of knowledge was reaching its peak, the network was beginning to function at least widely enough among skilled knowledge workers in the global north, and in particular in the United States, that alternate modes of production, anarchist production, production without secrecy and without ownership, could begin to challenge the technical satisfaction of proprietary software. And as I have tried to show over the past 2 weeks, we won. Not because of any contingent element, but really as a deterministic matter, for the reasons I discussed last week. For those who wondered about zero marginal cost economics as a key driver of late stage capitalism in the early 21st century, I offered you Martin Fink's book, The Business and Economics of Linux and Open Source. Martin, whom I have known now for almost a quarter century, has been a technical manager of businesses of multiple kinds, beginning in Canada and then in the United States. He was then the CTO of Hewlett-Packard. Well, not in 2003 when the book was published. He was still a senior technical executive, but not the CTO. He was later the CTO of Hewlett-Packard. And then at disk manufacturers and other hardware-focused businesses supporting or supplying the cloud. And Martin was an early adopter of the recognition that the businesses that made global IT were going to benefit from free software. His role in that activity at Hewlett-Packard was crucial to HP's adoption of the philosophy of being pro-free and open-source software, which they came to, as you see, at the very beginning of the 21st century, just a little later than IBM. These were not by any means anti-proprietary actors. IBM was the largest patenter in the world then and remained the largest patenter in the world up until the late part of this decade. Hewlett-Packard, too, was a company that lived on its patents, indeed, in the intervening period, far more than IBM, because Hewlett-Packard was, during the time of Carlton Fiorina and her immediate predecessors, Hewlett-Packard was a company sustained by a series of patents on inkjet printer cartridges, which were for it what a pipeline of molecules is to a patented molecules is to a pharmaceutical company. But what Martin's book does, for those who actually want to dive deep in the question of not why does anybody make software, but why does any corporation support and benefit and profit mightily from people volunteering to make software, Martin's book explains what happened in software before the mobile phone. That process of learning that sharing and enabling and collaborating widely across all barriers among firms, between educational and business orientations, that process of using a reduction of intellectual property friction to enable better software quality faster, which I described to you last time in the more general terms of zero marginal cost economics for reasons we shall come back to shortly, that process changed the way that businesses thought about the software that they distributed with their products. By the middle of the first decade of the 21st century, a year or two after Martin's book was published, IBM and Hewlett-Packard and Nokia and other companies of importance in IT and digital economy around the world had recognized that their model for the production of software was as natural resources. They didn't want to own the forest. They wanted to be able to take the products of the forest in a reliable and economically beneficial way without having to worry that somebody else was going to come and chop down or burn the forest, deplete the fishing stocks, and muddy up the groundwater. This is why the absolutely revolutionary natural resources economics of Eleanor Ostrom, which was sufficient to win her a Nobel Prize in economics that at that point nobody on earth seemed to believe that women could qualify to get, that turn towards thinking of software as a natural resource, it just gets made. Students make it. A kid in his mother's back bedroom in Helsinki can make an operating system that will come to dominate the world, that Richard Stallman sitting in a room with a rubber mattress and a computer in the MIT's artificial intelligence lab could make a compiler for C code that everybody in the world would use. That idea that software will get made, and the trick is knowing how to edit it, sharpen it, commercialize it, put it in the products that we sell to people and use it to make money. That what we want is a free flow of software in the network. That was comparatively easy for the most sophisticated companies on earth to understand. And I and my clients and comrades who wanted to make software this way, for reasons rather different from theirs, were by the end of the 1990s prepared to show how that arrangement could be made to work. A critical portion of the reduction of that friction and the release of all that intellectual energy was the reduction of the field strength of the intellectual property system, as I wrote in 1999. And what that meant in particular was the use of licensing. Licensing is now thought of, as almost everything is thought of in private law among big boys, as contractual. A license is an agreement, but it isn't. If I did still have an office I could go to and where we could be together, I could take an 18th century law dictionary off the shelf. I keep a copy of Giles Jacobs' new Dictionary of Law published in 1735 in my Columbia office, and it's useful for a legal historian like me, particularly the 18th century, who wants to know what words mean in their context, but it's also useful in the kind of secular long-term intellectual history of law, which law students might find valuable to learn. A dictionary of the common law at any time, 18th century, 19th century, even earlier, will define license the way Giles Jacob defines it, as a unilateral permission to make use of property. This is what, when I was a property teacher, I used to teach is license, an invitation to come to dinner in my home. If I invite you to come to dinner and the moment you cross the threshold I seek to sue you for trespass, the answer in the pleading is license. I had permission. He invited me. But I invited you for dinner, and if after dinner and dessert and a nightcap and you don't go, and if in the morning you're still there and after breakfast you refuse to leave, then, if I ask that you be hauled away and sue you for trespass, license will no longer be a good defense because I invited you for dinner and you were there the following day at lunch. The licensor, the giver of permission, and his or her intention in the giving of permission is the measure of the scope of the license, not a meeting of the minds, not a negotiated agreement, not what the judge thinks is fair under the circumstances, not even what is commercially reasonable, but what the permission intended when it was given. This is not to say that there aren't a lot of things that function as intellectual property licenses that are contracts. There are. Of course there are. Because they involve mutual exchanges of promises in which there are other obligations of performance beyond the giving of a single permission to use property. Because there are agreements for royalties and accounting and all the other pieces which can only be defined contractually and whose legal regime depends upon the agreement and the language in which it was expressed, and in which the appeal to external information about the relationship or the intentions of the parties is disfavored. But license, in the pure sense of the giving of permission, is what the engineers of a reduced friction system want. So the simplest of all the software licenses for free and open source software are what we call permissive licenses. They only give permission, and their permissions are extremely broad. Basically, here is some software. As long as you don't remove my copyright notices from it or otherwise act to deprive us, giving it to you, of the credit we're entitled to for having made the software, do what you want. And in particular, the permissive licenses don't require you to pass along that permission to the people who get your software. There have always been, in Microsoft Windows, pieces of software that were written in free software environments. Mac OS X, that pinnacle of proprietary so-called goodness made by the king of the undead, now dead, Mac OS X has as its centerpiece, its kernel, the bottom rung of the ladder of all the software in it, an operating system called FreeBSD, which is made, as you would guess, to be distributed in a free software style. But the license, the BSD license under which FreeBSD is made available by its many authors, the license says that it's okay to put it in a proprietary product and use it that way, because it just says, here, do whatever you want with the software. Don't take our notices out or deprive us of credit. And in that environment, the king of the undead, now dead, was always very happy to use open source software. It was just software that he didn't have to pay for and that he could take and improve in whatever way he wanted it. Years later, Larry Ellison of Oracle was to say to the Financial Times the same thing. I get this open source stuff. It means I can take it and do what I want with it. And some of it was distributed that way. But my client, my comrade Richard Stallman, not only invented GNU Emacs and the GNU project and the GNU compiler collection and the GNU debugger, Richard Stallman not only invented an astounding array of beautifully designed and deeply important software, he also designed the GNU general public license under which to distribute that software. The GNU GPL, which was written by Richard and by a Boston intellectual property licensing lawyer of enormous skill and ingenuity, Jerry Cohen, and published in 1991 in its second version. There was a first version of the GPL written only by Richard Stallman, but it needed legal repair. The GNU General Public License was distinct from the other ways of sharing software, because it said, here is some software. You can use it in any way you want. You can run the program for any purpose. That's freedom zero. The right to use the computer program that you are receiving for any purpose. You can modify this software in any way you want. And you can share this software, whether in the original version you received or in modified version. Here's the thing. Whatever you do by way of redistributing this software or works based upon this software, you must do using the same license terms that you got this stuff on. You must use this license. That process of requiring that downstream users receive the same rights that intermediate parties receive came to be called copyleft. From Stallman's point of view, that was all rights reversed, backwards C in a circle, and all the other jokes that this involved. But it wasn't merely irony, it was a political constitution, too. It said, the way we approach the sharing of software is to approach it on the basis of the user's rights, which are secured to each and every user using the legal mechanism which the law expects to be used for the exclusive benefit of the author. This is why it was copyleft, all rights reversed, because the author's power to exclude came instead to be in service of every user's right to run, to modify, to fix, to improve, to enhance, and to base new things upon. The user's rights were protected by the author's right to exclude because the author committed to exclude only those who did not secure the user's rights. And the user's rights included, most importantly for these purposes, the right to receive the source code and to be able to modify it, such that the work of programming, the creativity of programming, the fun of programming, would be available to every user to do whatever she wanted with it, including to make new products and offer them to people, and sell the products, if not the software, so long as she too gave to all the users downstream from her all the rights that she had in the raw material from which she started. This, the copyleft idea, which then I later, with Richard, improved into the GPLv3 and all the family of licenses which surround it, this crucial idea of copyleft was Richard's most important political and social achievement, one which I believe is greater than the technical achievements which he gave also birth to in his desire to create. The copyleft idea also appealed to those businesses which understood that what it was a frictionless form of joint venture with anybody who wanted to help. And by the time that the companies like Hewlett-Packard and IBM had begun to understand what they were doing in this area, I began to see the GPL used as a basic means of venturing together. Companies would form joint work groups and say, let's just GPL it all. When students came to work from university computer science departments in the companies for the summer and worked on valuable projects, and then the time came to go back to school, and the company and the student both wanted the project to continue and for the student to be able to work on it, there would have been an enormous overhead of employment or consulting and university permissions and overhead. And instead, it was easier to say, let's just GPL the whole thing, and then anybody in the world can work on it, including you. This process of leveling friction and reducing the problems of transactions costs in every direction was what drew business to the particular form of the copyleft. This wasn't an ideological or political question for these businesses. It wasn't an ideological or political question for the executives or even the lawyers and the technical workers within the companies. It was simply an extraordinarily effective way to make production happen without trouble. But in that very process, they also began to reconsider other aspects of their businesses. In year 2000, for example, we were busily working at the W3C, the Consortium of Standards Making, founded by Sir Tim Berners-Lee, the inventor of the web. We were busy at W3C working on the question of what policy there should be concerning patents on recommended technologies, a very important part of the standards making process in all the various forms of standards making in the global economy. But what happened at W3C in the winter of 2000 was that the standards organization and the companies that surrounded it began for the first time to imagine that they should require royalty-free access to the patents embedded in their standards. And a crucial part of that process was the decision of the IBM Corporation, which was the largest patent holder in the industry, that it could in particular accept a world in which either software practicing IBM patents was released under the GPL and similar licenses such that IBM would always have complete access to everything done based on any such software, no matter who had made it, or IBM wanted royalties on its patents whose claims were practiced in the software. Once IBM had seen that there was for it a beneficial alternative, either use our claims under copyleft or pay us royalties on them, we had an extraordinary alteration in the industry's relationship to its own patents. Richard Stallman and I dreamed for a decade and a half of some form of patent pool that could protect shared free software in which everybody would agree that as long as everybody had all the rights to use everything and every company could benefit, then everybody ought to cross-license all their claims that read on all that software so that everybody could use and improve and distribute in a cooperative way, no matter how much they competed in other aspects of the business. Thanks to IBM and other far-sighted companies in the first decade of the 21st century, when they were still hotly engaged in competition with Microsoft, which was then hostile to FOSS in every way that it is now friendly to FOSS, thanks to the companies that saw the need for such an arrangement, the Open Invention Network came into being. OIN now has more than 3,300 member companies around the world, all of whom agreed to cross-license all their patent claims with all the other companies that also cross-license all their claims, so far as those claims read on what is called Linux systems, which is everything from Android and its packages to the cloud-based network computing activities of the CNCF and of the Kubernetes crowd and all the rest. In other words, the broadest possible patent cross-licensing system operated across the entire world with members ranging from the Alibaba and the Tencent parts of the Chinese community to the IBM and Hewlett-Packard and Philips and all the stalwarts of the IT economy on both sides of the Atlantic Ocean. Patents, too, in other words, although still highly prized and very valuable real estate, patents are extraordinarily more valuable in real dollar terms in the IT industry now than they were a generation ago. It is now possible to find people transacting options on patents where the strike price of the option, money down, exceeds the average value of all the patents transacted every year in the IT industry in the world in real dollar terms, finite, constant dollar terms, from the beginning of the 21st century. All of that expansion of the value of patents, all the enormous value in the patent wars between Apple and Qualcomm and Google and Apple and all of the fighting that has gone on about patents in the IT industry, which makes a lot of smoke and does indeed facilitate a lot of lawyers' income, all of that hides beneath it the extraordinary expansion of patent cooperation over free software embodied in OIN and in its member companies' increasingly favorable policies towards reciprocity and cross-licensing for general social good. The consequence of all these reductions in friction was not only an immense expansion of profitability in the world of software-enabled services, what we now have by way of Google and Twitter and Facebook, that could not have existed without free software. If those companies had had to pay Microsoft one unit of operating system revenue, one copy of Windows, and one copy of Office, and one for each computer that they used, there would have been no way for any of those models to have flourished. And this is where our failure came to crown our success. The economics worked, the technology worked, the force of the idea of protecting users' rights as a way of making more profitable software and services worked. Users' rights, not so much. The copyleft was only one part of the environment of open source. And there are a lot of other possible means of reducing friction in the copyright system that don't involve the protection of users' rights. When my dear friend and colleague Larry Lessig, now long of the Harvard Law School, created the Creative Commons at the opening of the 21st century, Larry was explicitly working on the model of free software. Larry was a member of the board of directors of the Free Software Foundation. We sat there together for some years. A member of the board of directors of my Software Freedom Law Center, of my charity law practice. Creative Commons General Counsel Diane Peters remains a member of my board of directors at SFLC. The interaction between the world of free software and the world of Creative Commons free culture is intimate, genetic, and permanent. But what Larry was trying to do when he made Creative Commons was not to publish software licensing. Indeed, Creative Commons continues to this day to recommend the general public license, the GPL, as the license of in the Creative Commons intellectual environment for software. CC was trying to do for other forms of creative production what the GPL had done for software. That was to offer creators ways to collaborate beneficial to themselves through the reduction of freedom and the expansion of access. But the Creative Commons licenses aren't all copyleft licenses. Indeed, all but one of them are not copyleft licenses. Creative Commons uses the phrase share alike to denote the copyleft property of you must give users the rights you had in the material from which you started. CC BY SA, Creative Commons BY, that is Protect Attribution, Share Alike, which is the license of all the content of Wikipedia, for example, and MIT OpenCourseWare, and many another effort in the creation of free culture. BY-SA is only one of a collection of Creative Commons licenses, which also include licenses for non-commercial use only, and licenses that don't prohibit, that don't permit the making of derivative works, that are essentially verbatim sharing licenses, all of which are useful across a variety of fields of endeavor. The world of photography and photography licensing was altered completely by CC BY NC because professional photographers would like people to have access to their photographs. They would like them to be able to spread those photographs around and to add to their professional importance and reputation. They just don't want people putting those photographs in advertisements and using them to make money without paying for them. And so CC BY NC discriminated correctly from the point of view of photographers on the web between uses which are perfectly okay and ultimately beneficial to them through sharing and uses for which they need to get paid so that they can continue to take photographs. These processes of titrating the levels at which copyright exclusion occurs are the processes which allowed a vast number of business changes, some of which are positive and some of which are not, but all of which, as I suggested in 1999, when I pointed out that there were going to be earthquakes in the music and news business, turned out to occur. The processes of sharing the production and the distribution of creative works in the network changed everything because the network changed everything. But our goal, which was to ensure that users had rights, well, that took something of a beating, given the way in which others co-opted and made use of the principles of friction reduction that we pioneered for purposes that did not regard the rights of the user as the primary purpose or goal. A lot of effort came to be put, mostly in the original part of this process, by me alone, since I was the lawyer doing all of this for the world in the 1990s. A lot of effort came to be placed in making credible the rules of free software, and in particular of copyleft licensing. Making people understand that when we said you can have this code, but you have to give people the source code. They have to be able to get it. They have to know what their rights are. You have to show them this license every time. You have to make sure that people understand that just because they're users doesn't mean they have no rights, and you have to be prepared to give them what it would take to make real functional modified versions of this program and run them for themselves. These rules had to come to be respected. They were not conventional rules at all. And so much of my work in what I think of as the first generation of this, from the time I went to work with Richard Stallman in 1993 until the formation of the Software Freedom Law Center in 2005 and beyond, really until about 2012, the work that I was doing was the work of presenting a legal regime and making people believe in using it. We were poor. Microsoft was enormous, rich, and powerful beyond imagining, and it was our adversary. It wanted our way of doing things to cease to exist. Fortunately, we gained a little bit by smallness at the beginning, and modesty, and poverty, and humility, which were our primary tools. They didn't know until it was a little late just what an enormous threat to that way of doing things we posed. But mostly, we were people of goodwill. When I came to people who were not obeying the terms of the GPL, I was, from the very first time I ever did the work in 1995, I was enabled by my client to say two things of crucial importance. First of all, we don't want money. My instructions for my client from the first day I worked for Stallman on these questions were never allow a demand for royalties to interfere with a settlement for compliance with the rules. And thus I understood my instructions to permit me to say we don't want money. And then I could say the second most important thing, which is we don't want publicity. What we want is for everybody to play by the rules. So we would like you to comply with the rules. We won't take a thing more and we won't take a thing less. And once, by the beginning of the 21st century, we had some powerful companies on our side who could vouch for our goodwill, who could say to others that we should be taken seriously, who could help us in the corridors of power within the industry and among governments, we could attain that kind of credibility, and therefore that kind of cooperation. I gave you, from 2014, the second edition of my law practice's guide to compliance with the GPL and related licenses. A document written first by my associates and then later by me and my partner for the second edition, a document created specifically to teach lawyers, not computer programmers, how to understand these rules and how to apply them. The process of seeking compliance with these rules has long since ceased to be primarily a matter of chasing bad people and asking them to comply in some sort of police action. Because as the industries of IT and digital communications globalized around the world, it became possible to ask the supply chain itself to do the work of ensuring compliance. The organization called OpenChain, pioneered by a colleague and dear friend of mine then working as a lawyer for Qualcomm Technology Industries, the chip-making side of Qualcomm, OpenChain has in the last 8 years spread itself around the world, and now hundreds of companies participate in a process which gives them training materials and communications pathways and standard forms, so that everybody supplying everybody in the trade knows what the rules are for how to distribute free software upwards in the supply chain and how to make sure that everything is compliant and that it can be checked. Five companies in the world large manufacturers whose names you know. Five companies in the world buy one form or another of componentry from almost 90% of all the companies in the world that manufacture components. Whether those are chips with software in them, or software only, or devices with a few chips, each of which has some free software inside it, the component manufacturing business that extends out throughout the world to factories in Yunnan and in Malaysia and in Bulgaria and Kenya, the structures of manufacturing componentry reach very far down into the global economy, and they reach very far up to a few mountainous pinnacles. Each of those companies, the manufacturers that manufacture everything, whether they are the Korean ones, or the Japanese ones, or the American ones, or the Chinese ones, or the European ones, the companies that dominate the purchasing of all that componentry want everything that reaches them to be compliant. They want the rules to be just like the breathing of air, which is, after all, what, by the beginning of the 21st century, we were offering them. A rainforest in which goods are manufactured that float down the river to you for nothing. And then you take them and you put them in your products and you make a ton of money. But up there in the rainforest, you want the rules to be functioning correctly. You want there to be forest rangers. You want people protecting all of those traditional uses. You want people protecting all those vulnerable individuals who actually make this software in their high schools, in their colleges, in their graduate schools, in their startups. You want all of them to be able to count upon the fact that the rules will behave as they demand. One tiny little outgrowth of that is the Software Freedom Law Center and my practice, but a much more important outcome of that is OpenChain. And now the chain, the supply chain of the industries functions to turn our principles of licensing into rules that everybody knows how to obey. And I have shown you in this primer of ours basically both what the scope of that problem is and how it can most easily be solved in each operational context that a lawyer might discover for some company or other that it needs to follow the rules. We made every attempt along the way for those rules to be easy. And in the structure of an engagement that I built, in order to allow us to get people to agree to play by those rules, we wanted those rules not to be terribly onerous. And most importantly, we wanted to avoid any appearance of hypocrisy or the pursuit of particular advantage for one company over another. We were building, well, not quite, but something like a Switzerland, let's say. A neutrality in which competing entities could behave cooperatively with respect to standards, with respect to joint venturing, with respect to the support of technical education, and most importantly at the end, to improve the quality of software that they used in their businesses, with, for us, the reserved importance that this should work ultimately to protect users' rights. Law and technology and politics. The politics wasn't what interested the businesses. At least overtly, the politics wasn't what interested the universities. I had lived and worked at Columbia University teaching in the law school for 19 years before anybody in the computer science department ever thought that it might be worth inviting me around to give a lunch talk. And after those 19 years, when somebody invited me to come around to give a lunch talk, no professors of computer science showed up, not even the professor who had invited me. But I could barely get into the room because there were so many undergraduates and graduate students in computer science who wanted to hear what I had to say and to talk to me, because the politics was understood at the individual level, where the economics and the technology and the law were understood at higher hierarchical levels in the structure of American and then global IT industry. Even before the politics made any difference to the European Commission, which later came to understand those politics reasonably well, or to the staff of the majority on the House Judiciary Committee, which was writing not quite perfectly about open source and competition among the platform companies just last week, long before the political bodies had fully grasped why this was important, lots of young technologists had grasped why it was important. They worked on GPL projects, and they insisted that the projects they worked on be GPL because they did understand the political importance, at least the political importance to them. But from my point of view, this was always a political project, as it was for Richard Stallman. For me, as you hear in or read in the talk I gave in the House of the People's Deputies previously, that of the German Democratic Republic on the Alexanderplatz in Berlin in 2004, for me, this was part of the thousand-year effort to secure freedom of thought, part of the process by which we all came to have the right to think our own thoughts and make our own decisions about how to change what we had learned into that which we could teach. Not only, in my view, was this a political matter, a matter of the survival of freedom of thought, it was an improvement upon other ways of making those politics. Free software operates in the world by incremental improvement, which begins with the release of something that embodies proof of concept plus running code. In other words, somebody somewhere, some Linus Torvalds, some Richard Stallman, some Rasmus Lerdorf, creates something and says, here, I made this, it sort of works. Want to help me fix it, make it better? This process is a political process. It's a political process which begins by proving that something better is possible and by bringing people who desire that together to empower them to make it true. And that initial proof of concept running code is crucial to that process. Most of the great efforts at political and social change over the last 500 years have been based upon an idea of a knowingly improved world, first shown in Sir Thomas More's book of 1529, The Utopia. And this is both a blessing to the human race, which has been working itself towards a better and higher state of functioning for everyone on the basis of the ideas that More expressed in Utopia and ideas like it, and a curse, because Utopia means nowhere. Because it was an effort at visionary literature, like Edward Bellamy's Looking Backward or any other of the works of utopian socialism that followed it, because it described nowhere and left us wondering what was the bridge between where we are and the nowhere that we wish to get to. Isaiah Berlin, whom I think is the greatest political theorist of the 20th century, Isaiah Berlin made his life intellectually upon understanding the consequences of the turn towards utopia in the political thought of the North and West. Berlin's whole point was that the grasping at utopia produced for us a series of political events like the French Revolution, in which the effort to get to somewhere completely different, to transform human nature at a leap from us to new socialist man, in which this process of seeking to get to the previously unknown future inevitably falls short, creates subsistence crisis or other forms of incipient social failure, leading to the use of violence, leading to the collapse of the revolution, and the reanimation of the counterweight, the conservatism, the reactionary forms, the Napoleonic dictatorships, the Joseph de Maistre's of the world, the Gulag, Xinjiang, and so on. And what I wanted to say in Berlin in those hopeful moments at the beginning of the 21st century before the next several shitstorms hit, what I wanted to say was that free software was in itself a model of a new and different form of the political theory of freedom of thought, a model based not on the pursuit of utopia, the hope to go at a leap from where we are to a world we know is better but for which we do not know the road, and to replace that by a reliance upon proof of concept, running code, and the empowerment of the people to make the road by walking on it from here to the future to which they aspire, based on the proof of concept we already have. A non-utopian approach to the politics of revolutionary social change in the interest of the freedom of the people and the freedom of their thought. I did believe in 2004 that it was right to say that after 1,000 years of struggle, sacrifice, and death, we were in the generation that could win. The better part of a generation later, I am not so sure. But I understand the purpose for which we set out, the grandeur of the thing that we were trying to do, and the success we had at bringing about the changes in economy and technology and law that we needed. What happened in the world of software was, of course, only the prelude to what happened in the world of everything else, because software is the physiology of the network. Software determines who controls the switches. We made the changes that were necessary in order to support a network of freedom. But the changes that were necessary were not sufficient. And it became possible to use our tools, legal and economic, technical and civil. It became possible to use our tools to get a very different result. The Chinese Communist Party now is overtly trying to use those tools to get a result the opposite of those that we intended in every way, to eliminate the very idea of freedom of thought, or of users' rights, or of rights, or democracy in general from the world. The platform companies that together inside their skunkworks formulated the internal organs of the parasite with the mind of God, that have specialized in the creation of insecurity and sensationalism and self-doubt and hatred and humiliation for creating engagement with the parasite. The governments which believe that they can free software their way to digital sovereignty. Yes, you should be allowed to have end-to-end encryption in your WhatsApp unless, and oh my God, who will protect the children, as in a document from the Home Minister of the United Kingdom, Priti Patel, and the Attorney so-called General of the United States, Bill Barr, and others, which I was reading just this morning, oh my God, we have to break encryption to protect the children. All of that, the child I was, the one who worried about slavery in the 21st century, all of that I recognize as the nightmares of my youth, now made flesh and very real in the world, also made very different by the sorts of ideas that I and my contemporaries were breeding up as we went to work to make computers better and thinking about what could happen to freedom and the consequence. And all of that, well, as I say, journalism, music, the streaming revolution, the constant surveillance of everything you read and watch, the keeping track of everything you learn, the learning systems like Canvas that are primarily about surveilling you and only secondarily about teaching you, all of that is the beauty of what we did turned evil. I cannot blame it all on Sauron. The King of the Undead, now dead, was the greatest artist of the 20th century and a moral monster. But everything we have wasn't made by Steve Jobs. Just the profit was made by Steve Jobs. Here we come to this moment in this course in which I have said, look at all these people saying there's a terrible problem, we just don't know what it is. And I've said, yeah, we know what it is. We can explain it. It's the parasite with the mind of God and the use of sharing to extinguish rather than to further freedom and to increase our subjugation to the things that beep and buzz and carry on and watch our every move. But it doesn't have to be this way. Freedom begins by knowing that another world is possible. It continues by having proof of concept and a little running code and an open invitation to join and build. And there it meets the force of surveillance capitalism and the newly empowered state. In this course now, from here until the end, whatever date that is, when the sickness becomes too much and the university redissolves, in this course, from here to the end, we consider what has happened in the industries and private markets of the world. And if you care for yet more of this, the course in the spring, Computers, Privacy, and the Constitution, asks what happens when the states move in. But all of it begins from the unification of a political and a legal and a technical point of view, that sharing can be better than owning and that sharing can support freedom. We'll sum this up next week and move on to new terrain. Talk to you soon.